Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, the mass protests have rocked Iran and were met with a brutal crackdown by the state. In the long history of Iranian protest, is this time different? Why or why not? And first, how does climate change affect violent conflict? Why might it lead to violent conflict in some places, in humanitarian emergencies in others? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. Climate change brings an entire new range of security challenges throughout the world. Indeed, climate change is one of two issues that can pose even an existential crisis to the planet, the other being nuclear weapons. These climate alterations can lead to greater conflicts. And traditionally, when we think of climate security, climate conflict, we think of the way in which climate conditions lead to conditions where countries are much more vulnerable to war. But it can also lead to conditions that pose just broadly to governmental challenges, humanitarian needs, delivery of services, those sorts of issues. And those are security questions as well. On today's show, we're going to explore the challenges of climate security with the author of a new book on this topic. Joshua Busby is a professor of public affairs at the LBJ School of Public Affairs. This is at the University of Texas, Austin. And he's a senior research fellow at the Center for Climate and Security. He's the author of numerous articles like One More Try, the International Solar Alliance, and India's Search for Geopolitical Influence, and Assessing Resilience to Drought, Defining Drought, and Reviewing Trends in the Horn of Africa. But on today's show, we're going to focus on his new book. This book is entitled States and Nature, The Effects of Climate Change on Security. Professor Busby, thank you so much for joining us today. First question, climate and security. I kind of tried to address a couple of the issues with the intro, but I want to give you a chance to talk in more detail about this. What exactly is the relationship between climate change, broad questions of environmental degradation, and what we consider to be security?
Thanks for having me on, and that's a terrific question. 20 years ago, there was an emergent literature on environmental security that sought to broaden the definitions of security to encompass other risks to human well-being, like environmental change, that could be severe enough that they would rise to the level of what we call security problems. And about 10 to 15 years ago, the connections between climate change and security took off as a literature, both in academic circles, but also as a kind of community of practice. And so when we typically think of our understanding of security as armed external threats against the nation by foreign adversaries, but what environmental change and climate change raise is the question of, can other so-called actorless threats that come about not because there's an actor intentionally trying to do us harm, can other threats like climate change rise to the level of security problems, even if there's no other actor out there intentionally trying to bring it about? And scholars like me said, yes, that is possible, that the impacts of climate change could be so severe that they warrant being called security problems for a number of reasons, some of which have to do with the risk between climate change and armed conflict. But scholars like me go further to suggest that the extraordinary impacts of extreme weather events, because of their impacts on with the risk of large-scale loss of life, that those impacts themselves can be considered as security problems. And so that's really set the stage for me wanting to explore both the risks of climate change contributing to violence, but climate change contributing to other severe harms to humans that rise to the level of security problems.
Yeah. I'm going to delve into this definition of security. I want to start with real traditional arguments. Wars are often fought over resources, and environmental degradation means a lack of resources. So therefore, issues like climate change add to that, things like desertification and drought, etc., just simply mean there's fewer resources. How much in your research have you found that to be a pretty accurate, both a description and a fear about how environmental degradation leads to insecurity?
Yeah, sometimes it's a mix of both relative scarcity in some places and relative abundance in others. So what ends up happening is in one area, resources are degraded and people may have to move and come into contact with others where resources are relatively abundant, and that can set the stage for conflict. Some of the risks have to do with when people's livelihoods that are often bound up in agriculture become degraded or diminished, then the opportunity cost of engaging in violent activity go down. So people move from farming and they become easier to recruit for rebel movements, for example. The other impact of degraded environmental resources is that state capacity to repress violence diminishes because state resources, like the tax base, also is diminished. And so the country has less capability to repress violence. And so you may get the risk of violence happening as a consequence of both increased opportunities for people to engage in rebel movements, but also decreased capacity of the state to stop such violence, whether it's violence against the state or violence between social groups fighting with each other over access to grazing land or access to water or what have you. The broader literature over the last 20 years has said, though, that that only happens under specific sets of circumstances. And what my book tried to do is try to come to grips with under what conditions are we likely to see those kinds of effects, and going beyond just the risks of conflict, but as I talk about in the book, on the risks of humanitarian emergencies as well.
You have kind of three variables that you reference here to say, and climate having an impact on, and so to lay that out, one is state capacity or government capabilities, the ability of the state to actually perform its duties, to actually govern. The second being this institutional inclusion, and the third kind of assistance they're getting internationally all seem to be playing a significant role. I'm going to start with this question about the government being able to literally govern. And so, first of all, how is climate change, specifically in environmental degradation broadly, having this impact on just the government's ability to just meet the needs of its population?
I on some level, I take that as a given. Obviously, climate impacts state capacity, but in the moment of climate-related emergencies, states will have varying degrees of capacity to carry out certain functions and to deliver services. And when you think about climate-related emergencies, it's often like a severe drought or a severe cyclone. And so what we're concerned about is, do they have the capacity to prepare for and respond to that event? Right. And this is events focused, and we can talk more about the broader trends in climate change, which can over time also degrade state capacity. But if we're focused on climate-related emergencies that are affected by the broader process of climate change, but maybe telescoped in a shorter period of time, some states have limited capacity to deliver services to their people. So if there's a drought, they have limited capacity to provide them with food relief or emergency rations or services, or to help them move and find alternative sources of employment or whatever they may need. They may even have limited foresight capability, so they may be caught by surprise. So when it does occur, they haven't made preparations for it. But other states have much more capacity to deliver services, to foresee those droughts well in advance, and then establish mechanisms to prepare for that with pre-location of emergency rations. And then maybe food for work schemes or other kinds of measures that would ensure that in the event of a climate-related emergency, that the worst consequences don't come to pass. And that's also true for other kinds of hazards like cyclones. And so, states that have better foresight capabilities and early warning systems to tell people storm is coming, get to high ground, and then have built, say, purpose-built cyclone shelters, they're going to be much more capable of responding to those hazards when they do occur. And so that's sort of hazard-specific capacity for service delivery that really matters in a lot of these cases.
So at this point, again, when we think of security, and you do have one case that I will circle back to and talk about, why does war break out in, Syria but not Lebanon? But that's a fairly narrow view of security. So I mean, part of what you're describing here is just getting food to people in the midst of a humanitarian disaster, like a drought, or being able to deliver services when a cyclone hits, et cetera, that we actually have to think about that as a security question. And so I guess the question then is, first of all, is that an accurate description of the book? And secondly, what does that then mean about just the way we think about security?
Well, we often think about the integrity of the state from armed attack, but there was a move in the 1990s to broaden the concept of security to think about human security, about the impacts on communities and humans. And that definition was perhaps too broad because it basically said any threat to human well-being was a security threat. And I think large-scale loss of life qualifies as a sort of middle ground between the sort of expansive view of human security and then the traditional focus on violent conflict. And the reason I think it's important is that if a foreign adversary were to have killed, say, 260,000 people in Somalia, as what occurred in the context of that drought, then that is meaningful, right? Like if the damage and displacement that happened in New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina, right? If a foreign adversary were to have exacted that damage on the United States, we would treat that as a security problem. The only difference is that there, in some instances, there's a human agent intentionally trying to do us harm. But what distinguishes security problems from sort of run-of-the-mill public policy problems isn't the intentionality of an adversary, it's rather the severity of the impact. And so if there are severe impacts like large-scale loss of life, like hundreds of thousands of people are at risk of dying, then I argue that elevates it from just being a conventional public policy problem into being something extraordinary. And that's why, the national security establishment has elevated risks like COVID and pandemics to security threats because it could cause extraordinary damage to the country. And that's why I think it's appropriate to have these humanitarian emergencies like Myanmar's cyclone that killed 140,000 people, calling them security threats.
And the book, one of the things you do that I find really fascinating is this sort of comparative case studies to try to get at why the same environmental issues, the same environmental degradation, climate change, et cetera, had different effects in different countries. Let's start with the Somalia and Ethiopia and the issue of the drought. Obviously, Somalia has been is one of the most food insecure places in the world today. Ethiopia, not so much, though I love the fact that you referenced in the book that we'll remember Ethiopia as being food insecure in the 80s, but it's not as food insecure today. But they're actually suffering from the same environmental issues. So what's behind sort of the difference in levels of security between those two countries?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it gets at this comparative method that I decided to employ. In the 1990s, this emergent debate was initiated by scholars like Tad Homer-Dixon, Canadian scholar. And most of those were single case studies of individual events where there was some environmental degradation and violence ensued. And Mark Levy, who was a scholar most recently, well, he was at a variety of institutions. He was associated for many years with Columbia University. He wrote a piece in that said, what we really need are paired cases of countries that face similar exposure to environmental harms but have very different security outcomes. And nobody really ever took him up on that methodological observation. So I wanted to do that in this case. And when you think about Somalia and Ethiopia, you can compare them to each other, but you can also compare Ethiopia to itself over time, right? So Ethiopia in the 1980s, if you're of a certain age, you remember like the Live Aid concerts that were attempting to fundraise to support famine relief. Well, flash forward, 30 years, and Ethiopia became much less vulnerable to these kinds of famine risks, even though it still faces the physical risk, and those physical risks are accelerating with climate change. What it's been able to do is build state capacity to have those food for work schemes, to have those forecast capabilities, to have those, emergency rations provided. And those were very effective. Alongside improved inclusiveness of the country, they were not democratic, but they became what we call inclusive authoritarians, where their ethos of the governing regime was to try to prevent sort of mass famine type problems like they'd experienced previously as a form of national legitimation, right? And those efforts were supplemented by foreign assistance, which facilitated the country's ability to build that state capacity. And so you had a much more capable state, a more inclusive government that was assisted by flows of foreign assistance that were largely distributed relatively equitably. Now, Somalia, by contrast, has had virtually no functioning government during the last 30 years and has had much more difficulty tapping into foreign assistance because of risks that that would be diverted to the Islamist Al-Shabaab militia. And so you had crisis moments like the one in 2010, 2011, in which a not very capable, hardly capable government was buffeted by these strong physical risk of a drought, and the international community was unwilling to leverage lots of international assistance because they were worried it would be diverted by Al-Shabaab to support their ongoing campaigns of violence. And as a consequence, 260,000 people died above and beyond normal levels of mortality.
Now, this question about inclusion, you said Ethiopia wasn't really democratic, and but if the inclusion of communities leads to better outcomes in wrestling with these questions, fair to say that democracies just typically are going to perform better than the non-democracies because the likelihood is that populations are more inclusive, and maybe that's the way we should view the democracy, is exactly how inclusive, is that democracy?
Yeah, that's a great question. So when I think of political inclusion, it's are all interest groups represented in the political structure? And authoritarian governments can be inclusive without having sort of democratic processes of normal elections, competitive elections, free and fair press. The challenge of even inclusive authoritarians is backsliding. And so what you had in the Ethiopian context, if you followed it over the last few years, is you had a government that was initially led by the minority Tigrayans. You had the junior partner in the same government of the Oromo, who were far more numerous. But they were, even though it was a relatively inclusive system, the Oromo were sort of dissatisfied with their lot and wanted to have more control and leadership. And so when they got that, and the current president, Abiy Ahmed, is Oromo, on some level, that might have been the epitome of a more inclusive situation, but they then turned it around on the Tigrayans and persecuted them in a renewed civil war. So what you saw is more exclusivity in an authoritarian system. And so you actually have seen resurgent risks of violence of a system that was authoritarian becoming more exclusive. And so what I would say typically is that democracies, if you go back to Amartya Sen's classic book on famines, he basically said there's never been a famine in a functioning democracy. And it gets at the competitive elections disciplines politicians because they have to respond to their electorate. And they typically have free and fair press, which means that, problems that authoritarians typically clamp down and try and hide from their populace are seen and visible because of they're exposed in the media. And even inclusive authoritarians are likely to heavily control and censor the media and try and shield awareness of problems from the wider populace. And so I think that's why authoritarian systems tend to be less inclusive generally, although it is on occasion they will function relatively.
And you're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're talking about climate and security today with the author of a new book. Joshua Busby has written a new book entitled States and Nature: The Effects of Climate Change on Security. And Joshua Busby is from the University of Texas at Austin. This theme about democracy. So I think it's fair to say democracies are preferred. There can be inclusive authoritarian states that are better than, exclusionary authoritarian states and possibly failed states like Somalia. But now you have this comparative analysis with Myanmar, Bangladesh, and India. I imagine that particularly, say, India's responses to the cyclones is at least, in part improved because of it being democratic. How much is that, the democracy and the politics sort of at the core of the improved responses versus other factors?
Yeah, I think one of the challenges in this kind of case study analysis, it's difficult to establish relative causal weight. I think if you look at the data on inclusion, whether you say look at it in terms of the democratic regime or just being inclusive, the indicators that I use suggest India is more inclusive compared to either Bangladesh or Myanmar, but le relatively less inclusive than say compared to Denmark, for example. And you know, there are obviously inequalities of caste and religion that are legacies in the Indian setting. And over time, they have improved their state capacity, but I'm not sure if they improved their inclusiveness. And indeed, you may think of there being democratic backsliding in the Indian context over the last 10 years or so. And so they haven't really been tested. I mean, there have been extreme weather events of late, but it hasn't manifested in ways where you're seeing, say, I don't know, Muslim majority areas buffeted by extreme weather events that the state fails to respond to. So that's at least a positive sign. But I would worry about that in the current context, that the current leadership in India doesn't seem to have that same sort of breadth of inclusiveness in its orientation to its citizenry. And so if there were severe weather effects or other damage in, say, in areas where there were large Muslim populations, I would worry about that.
And you focus quite a bit on weather events, and then, which makes sense because I mean, climate change, the extreme weather that's coming from climate change, you know, is a manifestation of that. And when thinking about questions about capabilities, it seems, at least in part, what you're arguing here makes a lot of sense, is that governments need to be proactive at preparing for these sorts of events. I mean, if you're in South Asia, you know there's going to be cyclones. So, you know, how proactive can you be to be able to respond to that? It seems to me that India, at least, is becoming at least a bit more proactive on those questions. I wrestle with this question when it comes to environmental protection. Is it level of, you know, economic development? Because states tend to take environmental protections more seriously after they've industrialized. Is it the, you know, just in general concerns about environmental conditions within India? But is it fair to say India is becoming more proactive? They're becoming greener in those approaches, and so therefore much more likely to be able to manage an extreme a weather event than even, you know, their own comparison, say 10, 15 years ago.
Yes, I think that's true on but on some level, you know, it belies the fact that Bangladesh, which is a relatively poor country, has also developed those capabilities at a lower stage of development. But in India's case, they have been supporting those capabilities without very much foreign assistance. It's almost a point of pride to say, look, we can handle this on our own. Whereas in Bangladesh's case, they were much more welcoming of foreign assistance because they realized that they didn't have the resources to mobilize to do this on their own. But what it does suggest is that countries at different stages of wealth can have this foresight to build hazard-specific capabilities that really reduce their vulnerabilities to similar hazards. So both Bangladesh and India, despite different levels of wealth, have been able to ensure that when a severe cyclone comes, hardly anybody dies in either country. And that's a lesson that says you don't have to wait for, say, Bangladesh to get rich for it to be able to take on these concerns. And it also suggests that international assistance can be put to good use and really help diminish the risk of large-scale loss of life. Because it wasn't that long ago in the early 1990s when a severe cyclone hit Bangladesh and more than 100,000 people died. Now it might be 200 or 300, which is lamentable loss of life, but it's very different than what it was and not that long ago.
Your other case can kind of return back to a traditional security question when it comes to climate. This case of Syria and in Lebanon suggests, I guess, at one level, the US's response is, why should we care about loss of life around the world? Which, by the way, I mean, I would disagree with, but I don't know that the position of the White House would be different than, well, I mean, we care about Americans, America first, etc. But in the case of Syria and Lebanon, climate disasters, the drought, etc., seems to have led to two specific security risks that the Western countries, you know, have faced actually direct risks. The civil war in Syria leading to terrorist recruitment and global war on terror questions, and of course the refugee crisis coming out of Syria. Both of those seem to have been derived from the Syrian civil war, and then the Syrian civil war was at least partially enabled, if not caused, by climate change. So I guess the question here is, first of all, in your two cases, why did war break out in Syria rather than in Lebanon? And are there some lessons that we can learn about lack of response to climate change on issues like terrorism, refugeeism, civil war, etc.?
Yeah, it's a great question. So the classic argument, or at least the argument that's been articulated on Syria, is you had a severe drought in 2008, 2009 in eastern Syria. It led to such a severe impact on agriculture that you had hundreds of thousands, and it's difficult to know the number, hundreds of thousands of farmers that migrate to the cities and sort of swell the sort of exurban areas of Sunni communities in and around major cities in Syria. And so then the question is, when the protests against the regime kicked off, were these farmers who had been dislocated, who were swelling the peri-urban areas of these cities, were they among the first to fight and join the rebellion once it turned violent, or were they recruitable later? And it's very difficult to know with some precision, and I try to go through that in the book. But basically, a number of Syria observers suggest that they swelled the number of people who were potentially recruitable, and it diminished the ability to do conflict resolution in the east because tribal relationships were diminished. And so it made it maybe more, it made it easier for Islamist movements in the east of the country to recruit from those people who had remained. And the net consequence is, we get a conflagration that claims hundreds of thousands of lives that has spillover effects on neighboring countries. And then the question is, why did neighboring Lebanon, which had its own history of civil war that had actually been occupied by Syria, why did Lebanon, which was a fragile country that faced a drought around the same period of time, why did it not lapse into civil war? And the argument I ultimately make is that it's not clear that there were major differences in state capacity between the two countries. Neither of the two countries was all that capable in. There was maybe a little bit more state capacity in preventing, say, food price spikes in the Lebanese context. But, the legacy of Lebanon's previous civil war is this sort of confessional system of all sectarian groups represented in government. Now, it doesn't necessarily work all that well. It basically gives all the different stakeholders in Lebanese society a seat at the table in the Lebanese government, but there's a lot of self-dealing by these elites to skim off the largesse of the government and provide services to their own kin and clan, or at least actually, if not provide services, maybe just make money off the government. And so on some level, it may be an accident of circumstance that Lebanon hasn't lapsed into another civil war. If anything that I can point to is this reasonably inclusive system that's creaky and deficient that gives all the Lebanese faith groups some seat at the table in decision making, but they've also, lived through a previous civil war that maybe disciplines them in the way that it didn't in the Syrian context. So it's a messier, difficult answer that's harder to tell that story for Syria versus Lebanon, but it has to do with clearly on the Syrian side that they had deficient mismanagement of water resources, but they had an exclusive regime that was tailored to support the elites around the Assad family and broke down in their wider ability to have a willingness to provide services to the wider public, and they were cut off from international assistance at the time of the drought, and that had catastrophic consequences for Syria as a whole.
I think what you're describing here then is it's probably not fair to say climate change leads to war, but can lead to conditions where there's other factors involved, the most recent, the history of the war, who are the groups, how inclusive the societies are, how effective is the governance, is it democratic, etc. Those sorts of questions all are essential to understand whether or not a country is going to plunge into war. But climate change and environmental degradation make those issues all the more salient. It can help create conditions that could cause a war and make that more likely. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, I think Can you tell the story of the Syrian civil war without the drought? And I don't think you can. You wouldn't have had that large scale mass movement of hundreds of thousands of people to peri-urban areas to have no to have to be recruitable to participate in that violence. And so now there may have been other deficiencies in the Syrian society that made it susceptible to break down like that. But it happened that the drought was one of the key precipitating sequences that made the country much more vulnerable. Now, the final spark might have been, the protest movements by young men in Daraa about how they wanted to, follow the lead of other states in the region that were experiencing the Arab Spring. That's a maybe final spark, but we can't tell the story about the Syrian civil war without acknowledging the really important role that the drought played in destabilizing the country further, with hundreds of thousands of people moved from their traditional agricultural livelihoods and having to remake their lives in and around major cities. And so I think that's why in this instance, it's appropriate to include it.
Absolutely. Now, we've been spending the entire time talking about conflict, talking about security risks, the way that climate, is leading to that. But I would like to leave, we got a few minutes left, and I do want to talk about some of the more positive steps. What can states and what can international actors do to try to improve these responses? What are some of the lessons from your book about what are the best ways to address these climate risks, these climate crises?
In my book, the two primary examples of countries being able to prepare for and reduce the risk of climate security consequences are Bangladesh and Ethiopia. Bangladesh has been able to prepare for large-scale risk of mortality from cyclones, reducing them from hundreds of thousands of people dying to hardly anybody dying through a combination of forecasting, early warning systems, and purpose-built cyclone shelters. In Ethiopia's case, despite recent backsliding, what they were able to do is reduce the risk of large-scale loss of life and death from famine in the 1980s to hardly anybody dying in the 2010, again, through forecasting, through pre-location of emergency rations, through food for work schemes, and the like. And that's a hopeful story that suggests the worst consequences of climate change need not come to be, that they're not inevitable, that the relatively poor countries with modest outside help can really reduce the risk. And we've seen in other examples, this is trying to be emulated with the United Nations climate security advisors. Even in places like Somalia, they're trying to help local communities come together to prepare for these risks. And this is something that in my service at the Department of Defense, as a senior climate advisor from 2021 to 2023, we were trying to take some small steps to improve the resilience of allies and partners so that they would be better prepared to foresee these risks and ready their societies for them. And we're not in a good moment for helping other countries do that right now in the United States, but I'd like to think that if the policy environment becomes more favorable, that we have lessons from around the world that it can be done.
No, and I guess last question then is, and with that in mind, the US certainly hasn't been answering the call. Internationally, though, are there other actors that could fill that gap if the US isn't doing it?
I'd like to think so, but the reality is that U.S. stepping away has also made it easier for other governments to reduce their patterns of foreign assistance. And we haven't seen many other actors step in a significant way. What we see is isolated cases. Like, I've been heartened to see NGO groups like World Food Kitchen, led by Chef Andres, that whenever there is an extreme weather event like the hurricane in Jamaica, or even the Hurricane Helene in Western North Carolina, one of the first actors to show up is this NGO group that's able to provide food for people in times of need. Now, that doesn't answer the call of the scale that's going to be required. And so the U.S. withdrawal from foreign assistance in a significant way is worrisome. And I don't think it's being filled in an adequate level by other state actors. And there are some signs that the U.S. is actually realizing that it made a mistake and is going to try and top up some of those humanitarian resources. But It also doesn't address the wider risks that we're seeing with more countries at risk of violence. And so I think that's an important, significant development that, Chef Andres and other efforts, noteworthy as they are, won't be able to address.
Yeah, it's important to remember that sometimes the scope of the action require governmental action, and not just a large government of the United States, but the U.S. leading a coalition, leading other countries that will join it in being able to build. And again, those three variables: building the government's capability to wrestle with these issues, ensuring that it's inclusive, and then this international assistance. That'll be able to help it. I guess I'm going to ask you one last question. We've been focusing so much on adaptation. Would you like to, sort of finish with a call for some action on mitigation? That one way we can address these issues is to address climate change.
Yeah, that's another important lesson that comes out some of the later chapters is that we can't adapt our way out of this problem. Runaway climate change would make all of these climate security consequences, it would overwhelm state capacity to prepare for them. So while at modest levels of warming, we're able to adapt and diminish the risks of large-scale loss of life and conflict, runaway climate change would make these problems far worse. And so the swift decarbonization to clean energy sources is an imperative, not simply from an environmental perspective, but from a global security and from a national security perspective. It has other problems of its own, as we see about contestation over critical minerals and the like, but we have to do it. We need to do it carefully, thoughtfully, and try to minimize those adverse consequences that flow from them. But again, we can't adapt our way out of this problem. And so I counsel at the same time as we move as swiftly as we can to decarbonize our economies, we also, adapt to the inevitable warming that we're already being affected by. But it's not an either or, it's a both and.
That's a great place to end. Our guest has been Joshua Busby. He's the professor of public affairs at the LBJ School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas in Austin. He's also a senior research fellow at the Center for Climate and Security, the author of numerous works. The one we've been talking about is a new book that has just come out. It's entitled States and Nature: The Effects of Climate Change on Security. Joshua Busby, thank you so much for joining us, for sharing the book with us, and sharing your time and expertise on these issues.
Thanks so much for having me, and look forward to being with you sometime again.
When we come back, what makes the latest Iranian protests and the state's response similar or different from the country's long history of demonstrations? Stay with us. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Iran has cracked down hard on the mass demonstrations, killing thousands of people. Is this the regime's most violent response? And if so, what explains its extremism? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. For the last few weeks, protesters in Iran have rocked the nation with demands for government change, some even demanding an end to the Islamic Republic. And what's striking about these protests is how familiar they are. Iran has a long history of protests, including mass nonviolent protests, and one of the most important of which took down the Shah's regime and established the Islamic Republic. In this segment, we're going to explore the history of protest in Iran and how these protests fit into the history and historical patterns. Our guest is Ervand Abrahamian. He is Distinguished Professor Emeritus at Baruch College in City University of New York. He's the author of A History of Modern Iran and Inventing the Axis of Evil: The Truth About North Korea, Iran, and Syria. Professor Abrahamian, thank you so much for joining us. I keep hearing news reports about the protests in Iran, the size of these protests, the government's violent response, to that. And so my first question is, are these protests, do they fit the historic pattern of protests in Iran? Are they, am I right that they feel familiar, or is there something particularly unique about these?
It is basically in the tradition of protests, but there are some differences, I think, in this recent ones. But in Iranian history from 1900, you have the major crises are often in the street. And this is quite natural when there are no political, basically, channels to move resentments, criticisms to the government. Obviously, people go to the street. So you have the Constitutional Revolution, 1906, was done in the streets. Then it's forgotten, actually, the oil nationalization under Mossad there. That was really done in the streets, too, because in the Majlis, there were only a handful of deputies who were actually for voting for nationalization of oil. But the masses of the people in the street were very much for it. And then, of course, as what you mentioned, the 1978-79 revolution, there was their massive protests, 3 million people in the street calling for the end of the Shah, calling for basically a republic. So in that way, this fits into the pattern. There are differences, though. Here, one difference you see is it's much more violent. In the past, there were some violence, but on the whole, it was r limited. Here, the state has taken actually strong measures of really killing massive number of people. In previous protests, basically, there was some restraint on how much firepower was used on the demonstrators. So that's one big difference. Also, there is tendency this time with the demonstrators also using violence. In the past, it was always actually very much controlled. The protests were basically stressed that this was a peaceful march. You can have slogans, but you don't use violence. If there was violence, it was often against special stores, special offices, not against human beings. So here there's that difference. There's another difference, which may be just temporary. In the previous ones, the demonstrations were also accompanied by strikes, even general strikes. For instance, the oil nationalization, oil workers went on complete strike. That helped the na nationalization movement. In 79, actually, what really brought down the regime was not so much demonstrations, but a general strike throughout the country, including the oil workers. Here, so far, no sign of a general strike. There was a strike in the bazaar, but nothing such as oil workers, which are crucial, basically saying we're not going to work until the government resigns. So that could happen in the near future, but it hasn't happened yet.
What do you attribute to this violence? Because I mean, I know that the government's res the government responding violently. They certainly did in 78, 79 in the revolution. So the government's spate of violence isn't necessarily surprising. Though, first of all, is it more significant now than in most cases? Is the government more violent now than they have been in the past?
Yes. During the actual Islamic Revolution, 78, 79, there were a lot of big numbers thrown out. Actually, after the revolution, the new regime claimed 63,000 people were killed in the revolution. Actually, I mean, I've studied the numbers, and when you actually look at the actual people you could locate, and the government actually in 80 produced a book of martyrs of the revolution. The figure was more like 600, not 60,000. Okay, there was a lot of exaggeration there, but there was a significant number. It was, I mean, 600 is a lot, but it's nothing compared to the present. And the present's more, it's probably 6,000 were killed last week.
And is that contributing then to the violence from the protesters, or is there something else that's driving the fact that this protest is more violent than historically they have been?
I think it's because of the government for use of violence, so people are willing to resort to violence, yes. Especially attacks on buildings. And it's often forgotten, actually, in the urban areas of Iran, people don't have guns. That's not normal town. But in the countryside, it's very much like the American heartland. A lot of people do have guns, so it could really turn very bloody.
And these protests have been throughout the country, right? And then is that also historically been the tradition, or have the protests tended to focus on the cities?
In the past, it was cities. In the 78, 79, the smaller towns. This time it's actually tends to be much more nationwide. Even small towns that didn't go through the revolution are seeing protests now. I mean, the economic situation is much more drastic now. But what is actually often forgotten is why is the economy collapsing? Okay. And some people say, you know, it's because of corruption, because of inefficiency. Those are true. But the real issue is, in fact, in Washington. There has been draconian, basically, embargo on the economy, so-called sanctions. And this has really throttled the economy. So there's been drastic decline in the standard of living. So the middle class has almost disappeared. And the poor class, the underclass, has actually dramatically increased. Malnutrition has increased, but basically, it's been a disintegration of the economy, and that's all due to sanctions.
Now, I know this is going to be a hard question to answer because just getting information out of Iran is difficult. But do you have a sense, the people participating in the protests, is it pretty much a cross section of society, including like generationally as well as, class and, it, because we you highlighted the rural versus urban, or is there a specific group that's really driving these protests?
I would say it's mostly youth. I think the older generation are more wary of actually political protests because they're worried about what could happen. The younger generation are so pissed off at the regime that they're protesting out of desperation. And often, many of them blame the government rather than Washington for the economic decline. I mean, they know the government is there. They hate the government, so it's easy to blame the government. And one way of blaming it is actually to say the previous regime was better. So there is the resurrection of the Shah, and even call of the return of the Shah. It's not because of any love for the old regime. It's just dislike of the present regime.
Yeah, actually, you're anticipating my next question, which is how much are these protests pretty leaderless? Just kind of an expression of, of anger as opposed to being directed by any individual. Because I've heard the same thing that the impact of Reza Pahlavi is more sort of, it's not that he's driving it, he's kind of inserting himself into into that process. Is that because there really isn't a leader? And has that traditionally been the role in protests in Iran, that they've tended to be leaderless, or are they usually, driven, directed by individuals or groups?
No, in the past, actually, you had, of course, in 78, 79, you had Khomeini as the sort of charismatic leader. Here, there is no organization. But where I think the Shah comes in is in the internet system. That's dominated by the diaspora. And in the diaspora, the monarchists dominate. mainly because the money. Then the question is, where does the money come from? It used to come from the Saudis. It doesn't anymore. It probably comes in from Israel. So there's a connection between the monarchists and Israel on this. So in the internet, basically, people listen to internet because they don't trust the local media. So their information is, in fact, coming through royalist perspective.
No, I mean,
They're, in fact, very much enamored by Trump because there's a link between the monarchists and the Trump administration.
and that I'm sure has a significant impact on recommendations for that. And I want to get to that, but there's one question I want to ask before, and that's the anger here and the sort of the extension. Is this in any way an extension of the protests that emerged with the murder of Mahsa Amini and the generally sort of gendered protests? I know they're separate issues, but how much is this an extension of that protest period?
I think they merged. I mean, I think basically the whole political discourse of the country has changed. It used to be all Islam, return to Islam, Islam has the answers. That discourse has been basically debunked. For the new generation, it's much more discourse of what are my rights? It's actually a sort of enlightenment discourse of I have natural rights and the government is infringing on my rights. And then, of course, what you have is ironically, the regime has expanded dramatically higher education. After the revolution, there was a dramatic growth in universities, technical science, schools, and so on. So you have a whole generation of people who are educated in basically technology. And with the economic crisis, they can't find jobs. So there's a lot of economic discontent that feeds into the political discontent.
Yeah, and of course, a talented and educated young population that has the education, but they don't have a whole lot of economic opportunity, certainly seems to be quite a combustible combination for protest.
Yeah.
Yeah. Last question then is the US has been threatening military action. In fact, there was apparently an Iranian drone that was shot down. We're recording this on Tuesday the 3rd, a drone shot down earlier today. The US always has a specter of a military strikes, of a military response to this. If the US does, in fact, choose to do this, do you think generally it would have a more positive effect on the protest and the likelihood of significant changes? Or do you imagine the Iranians would probably, rally around the state because they're being attacked?
But I don't understand what it means having a military attack. I mean, how are they going to protect protesters? Okay, you can attack, try to kill more Revolutionary Guards or something in the 12-day war, for instance. But I don't know how that's going to change the calculus. It's not going to bring down the regime unless you have a massive attack of decapitation of the whole government. Maybe that's the plan. If you have a decapitation of the regime, then the usual idea is, well, you have regime change, you have someone coming in, but there is no alternative. So the likelihood, if there was that scenario of decapitation, what could be is actually just a Hobbesian nightmare, similar to what happened in Iraq, in Syria, Lebanon, a disintegration of the state and complete chaos. Almost a million people died in Iraq after the so-called liberation of Iraq. So you could have an internal disintegration. And I'm worried that that maybe actually that's what the intentions of Israel and the United States is. It's not regime change, because I think they're smart enough to know that regime change is not in the books. But what you could have is a complete disintegration of the society.
So minute or so left. This is going to be a complicated question without anywhere near as much time. But do you have a sense if you were recommending what we outside, what we should do in support of the protesters? I mean, I personally would like to see a much more progressive state within Iran.
Obama had the answer. There was a perfectly good agreement. And if the agreement was put into effect, it would have actually strengthened the moderates, more sensible people in the regime. And you wouldn't have had this economic crisis. You could have had normalization of relations. And I think, I mean, that was basically the Obama strategy. And then you had Trump come in, it pulls the rug out. And the best I think they could get in negotiations, in fact, if there was a negotiation, as like there is now in Istanbul, the best actually would be going back to that. So Trump could claim it's a completely new agreement, but in fact, that was a perfectly good agreement in that Iran would have less sanctions. And Iran was actually monitored very carefully that it wouldn't develop a bomb. That was basically a perfect solution.
And the challenge, of course, is to make an agreement with the state that made an agreement and then walked away from it. There's a trust level that would make that any agreement difficult.
Except for Iranians have no choice. I mean, it would make sense for them to agree to that. But whether Trump would be able to actually swallow that, after saying it was the worst agreement ever made, you know, he can also backtrack a lot, so it's possible.
Our guest today has been Erivand Abrahamian. He's Distinguished Professor Emeritus at Baruch College at City University of New York and the author of A History of Modern Iran and Inventing the Axis of Evil: The Truth About North Korea, Iran, and Syria. Professor Abrahamian, thank you so much for joining us and sharing your time and your expertise.
Thanks for the invitation. Thank you.
And that's it for today's program. Thank you for listening. The Scholar Circle is hosted by Doug Becker. Its managing producer is Ankina Agassian. Sed Dongre is our webmaster and assistant producer. Our archives are at scholarcircle.org, and our podcasts are on Apple and Google Podcasts and iTunes. Please follow us on at Scholar Circle or me at Armudian and join our Facebook page. I'm the founder, anchor, and occasional host, Maria Armudian.